The intersection of Westlake Street and Girard Avenue South in Minneapolis carried a heavy, humid stillness on the night of June 13, 2021. It was a space that had become a permanent vigil, marked by makeshift barriers and the lingering scent of spray paint and extinguished candles. My boots crunched over dried wax and debris as I walked the perimeter, tracing the invisible lines where a community's grief met the cold reality of a crime scene. The streetlights cast long, flickering shadows across the pavement, illuminating the gaps in the crowd that had gathered to protest a recent federal task force shooting. There was no wind to cut through the heat, only the low hum of distant sirens and the rhythmic chanting of those standing guard over the memorial. I looked down at the tire marks burned into the asphalt, deep gouges that told a story of sudden violent kinetic energy cutting through a static crowd. At the center of that violence sat a crumpled vehicle and a void where a life had been just moments before. The air was thick with the smell of gasoline and burnt rubber, a sharp contrast to the flowers lining the sidewalk. I stood there for a long time, mapping the geometry of the impact in my mind, before I finally looked at the identification recovered from the scene. The name on the file was Diona Marie Knajdek. The chronological reconstruction of that evening began with a series of graining surveillance feeds and witness statements that painted a picture of a city already on edge. Diona had arrived at the intersection earlier that day, joining a group of demonstrators who had occupied the space following the death of Winston Boogie Smith Jr. My review of the initial police logs showed that the area had been largely peaceful, with protesters using their own vehicles to block traffic and create a safe zone for the vigil. Diona had parked her car at the edge of the line, acting as a physical buffer between the crowd and oncoming traffic. Throughout the afternoon and into the evening, the atmosphere remained somber but orderly. Witnesses described her as being deeply committed to the cause, often seen coordinating with others to ensure the safety of those present. As the sun went down, the crowd thinned slightly, but a dedicated core remained within the barricades. There was no indication from any official dispatch that a high-speed threat was approaching the area. The surrounding streets were busy, but the specific block of Lake Street was clearly marked by the presence of large, stationary objects and human beings. My investigation into the driver's movements prior to the crash required a meticulous look at several hours of digital footprints and traffic camera data. The suspect, later identified as Nicholas Ricky Moraine, had been operating a large Jeep Cherokee. Data pulled from nearby intersections showed the vehicle moving through the uptown district with a consistency that suggested a lack of regard for the established blockades. As the Jeep turned onto Lake Street, its speed began to increase significantly, deviating from the flow of local traffic. I interviewed several motorists who had been bypassed by the Jeep in the blocks leading up to Girard Avenue. They described a driver who seemed focused on a direct path, showing no signs of slowing down as the protest barriers came into view. The mechanical state of the vehicle was confirmed to be functional, with no evidence of brake failure or steering malfunctions that would have prevented a controlled stop. The trajectory was a straight line toward the center of the crowd. The impact occurred at approximately 11:39 p.m., with a force that sent Diona's parked vehicle flying into the gathered protesters. When I examined the forensic photos of the secondary collision, the sheer displacement of the metal was staggering. Diona had been standing near her car, or possibly just inside it, when the Jeep struck the rear of her vehicle at a high rate of speed. The physics of the crash dictated that her car became a projectile, hitting her and several others before coming to a rest further down the block. I walked the path of the debris field, noting how far the glass and plastic had traveled from the initial point of contact. It was a distance that could only be achieved by a vehicle traveling well above the posted speed limit. Protesters on the scene immediately swarmed the Jeep, preventing the driver from fleeing as they waited for emergency services to arrive. Medics attempted life-saving measures on the pavement, but the injuries sustained from the blunt force trauma were too extensive. Diona was transported to the Hennepin County Medical Center, where she was officially pronounced dead. The forensic evidence and digital recordings formed the backbone of the subsequent criminal case. I spent dozens of hours reviewing cell phone videos captured by bystanders, which provided a synchronized multi-angle view of the moments leading up to the collision. In these videos, the sound of the Jeep's engine is audible over the crowd, a rising roar that precedes the visual of the headlights by only a split second. There was no sound of screeching tires or attempted braking before the loud, metallic crunch of the impact. I cross-referenced this with the Jeep's internal computer system, which recorded the throttle position and speed at the time of the crash. The data confirmed that the vehicle was traveling at nearly 70 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone. The accelerator was depressed firmly, and the brakes were not applied until after the initial collision had already occurred. This technical readout removed any ambiguity regarding the driver's intent to maintain speed despite the visible obstructions in the roadway. Blood samples taken from the driver at the scene were processed through the state crime lab. The results indicated the presence of controlled substances in his system, a factor that fundamentally shifted the direction of the investigation. When I reviewed his prior records, I found a history of driving offenses and interactions with law enforcement that suggested a pattern of reckless behavior. The toxicology report became a primary piece of evidence, linking his impaired state to the catastrophic lack of judgment displayed on Lake Street. I also examined the physical evidence inside the Jeep, which included empty containers and personal items that corroborated a period of prolonged intoxication leading up to the event. The digital reconstruction of the crash site, combined with the chemical analysis, provided a comprehensive narrative of a preventable tragedy fueled by substance abuse and extreme negligence. The legal proceedings against Nicholas Moraine were swift once the full scope of the evidence was presented to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. He was initially charged with second-degree intentional murder and assault with a dangerous weapon. During the discovery phase, my team provided the prosecution with the exact timings of the vehicle's movements, proving that he had ample opportunity to see the crowd and choose a different route. The defense attempted to argue that the blockades were illegal and that the driver was startled by the protesters, but the high-speed data and lack of braking maneuvers made that position difficult to maintain. The presence of drugs in his system further undermined any claim of a simple accident or defensive reaction. The community's reaction to the proceedings remained intense, with many viewing the case as a litmus test for how the legal system valued the lives of activists. In the finality of the court's decision, the charges were ultimately narrowed to focus on the most provable aspects of the crime under Minnesota law. Marin eventually entered a guilty plea to one count of second-degree unintentional murder while committing a felony and one count of assault in the second degree. During the sentencing hearing, the court reviewed the victim impact statements, which detailed Deonna's life as a mother of two and her history of community service. The judge noted the extreme risk the driver posed to the public and the devastating consequences of his actions. Mirren was sentenced to 20 years in prison, a term reflecting the severity of the loss of life and the injuries caused to the other protesters. He was remanded to the custody of the Minnesota Department of Corrections to serve his sentence. The intersection of Lake and Girard was eventually cleared of the physical barricades, but the marks on the asphalt remained for years as a silent witness to the events of June 13th. I returned to the site one last time after the case was closed. The makeshift memorial had been replaced by more permanent tributes, and the flow of traffic had returned to its normal, rhythmic pace. The investigative file was thick, filled with the technical minutiae of velocity, toxicology, and digital timestamps. Yet it all pointed to a single, irreversible moment of violence. Deonna Marie Knajek was 31 years old when she was killed. Her death remains a documented fact in the history of the city's unrest, a data point in a larger conversation about safety, protest, and the lethal potential of a vehicle in the hands of an impaired driver. The files were boxed and moved to long-term storage, ending my official involvement in the reconstruction of that night.